Hello and welcome to another episode of the CBO Speaks podcast. I'm your host, Donna Shealy. So glad you all could join us today. Today's guest is Clayton Gibson. He is the Vice President for Finance and Administration and CFO at the University of North Texas. Welcome, Clayton.
It's great to be here, Donna. Thanks for the invite.
Awesome. So glad to have you. So I want to go all the way back. We have in common that we started our undergrad careers at HBCUs. I want to talk about your educational journey starting at South Carolina State and kind of take us through there and then what came next.
Yes, I have all good things to say about South Carolina State University, both my undergrad and grad afterwards. So starting there as a freshman, I had a lot to learn about the world. My thought was to charge through college as fast as possible in, you know, 3.5 years or however short period it can take and just get into the working world. And somewhere in my second year is where I really started to develop a lot of meaningful relationships with folks. And a lot of that was through student organizations, right? You get exposed to folks who think completely different and you're all still working together to achieve a common goal, or you all still have common interest, right? And you can harvest that to do a lot of good things. So I ended up being a tutor for 3 years for the athletes, you know, the football players, the basketball players, you know, for 3 years. I ended up being president of my residence hall. I ended up as president of the Senate for the Student Government Association. So I had a lot of robust experiences. And one of the good things about going to an HBCU is that you get a nurturing experience, meaning, you know, you're coming into college and there's going to be rigor and you've got to rise to the occasion. But you also have folks that will get behind you and look out for your best interest, you know, because it really is a community. And I can truly say the folks on the South Carolina State University campus were community oriented and took our best interest at heart.
What led you to an HBCU in the first place? Did you have family that went to HBCUs as well? How did you even end up at an HBCU?
Yes, I had a cousin that was at South Carolina State University, had another cousin that was at Spelman. So I've had a number of relatives that have gone through HBCUs and other institutions as well, you know, and they've all done well. And you know, I say to folks, a big part of who you become is what you choose to be, right? You can harness any environment to be your best. And, you know, there was a great environment there for harnessing talent. I had a lot of very direct outside classroom conversations with finance professors while they're about investing in the stock market. It had nothing to do with class. It was just going back and forth on what they were invested in. And they provided a lot of opportunities for advancement. They created classes that were catered towards the career goals. We had a lot of us wanted to be in investment banking, and that's a interesting one for me. My original goal was to be a chemist. So I started college as a chemistry major. I actually did a chemistry internship for an entire summer. And then I came back after that summer and said, I can't do this. I can't sit in this lab all summer. This is not going to work. So I came back and changed my major to economics. And I did that after consulting with some folks in the College of Business that I had developed a relationship with, as well as some other students that were seniors who had started to get careers on Wall Street and internships and were giving me feedback on, but here's what a future could look like, or here are the type of skill sets that they're looking for.
And so then you went to the University of Notre Dame, is that correct, to get your master's in accountancy? Talk a little bit about that.
That's right. So I did my undergrad degree in economics, and I went on to University of Notre Dame in Indiana to do my master's in accountancy, which is what they call it, and another great experience, right? Very different environments as far as size and even resources, right? But, you know, both were environments where I felt like people cared, and they helped provide tools for us to be our best. You know, I developed a lot of good relationships with classmates and professors. And the good thing about Notre Dame, too, is that the university has access to a lot of folks that are high achievers. So folks that can come back and do a one-off cameos, lecturing in classes, talking about their real-time experiences. Faculty members that will hold you in a office to help give a little bit more insight as far as here's how this assignment relates to the real world. And I also played a lot of soccer, so it wasn't just work. You know, there were a lot of meaningful recreational activities that we engaged in outside of classroom to become better people.
Well, let's now talk about your career path. Once you finished your education and you started to work, what was your first career opportunity right out of school?
So that would be Ernst & Young, Chicago office, and public accounting. So I did that for a number of years, started as a staff accountant. And it's a really good thing starting as a staff auditor with a degree in accounting, because you get to see a laundry list of different types of clients. You work on different types of teams. You're moving from one team this week to a different team the next week. So you get to see a lot of diversity in industries. I worked on banks, insurance companies, a lot of real estate companies. I got to see folks that did a really good job and had best practices, and sometimes they thrived even during recessions. And then there were others where, and we were there to audit, not render an opinion on their management skills, but you still get to observe. You get to spend time with folks that you would normally have no business being in their office, the CFO, asking them questions to complete a risk assessment. So I really credit that time to a lot of my career mindset, because I got to see so much, so many different types of industries, different ways people do things, and also to have a template for how to get up to speed in different environments quickly, because you're moving from different industries and different clients and different projects. So after a while, you've got to develop a template for how to swim in any environment.
Yeah. Now, how long were you there at Ernst & Young?
I was there for 6 years.
6 years. Wow, that's great. In Chicago the whole time.
Cold weather.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. Well, you were kind of used to it after being in Indiana for a little bit, so I'm sure it wasn't too bad. So after Ernst & Young, then where did you move into?
Yeah, so a career opportunity came up in higher education, you know, afterwards. And just so you know, it's not a typical step going from, you know, a big four accounting firm and that pathway to moving into higher education. But a career opportunity came about to lead the compliance office for a smaller regional university, which is also an HBCU minority serving in Alabama. And I found that to be attractive because I had family members there and my wife was pregnant, so we were expecting, and you know, it was really important to be able to be there, to be present, you know, as a dad, right? So that did play an important part, you know. And you know, I applied and you know, took the interview, and it worked out well. That was a career change that could have been scary as well. It's easy to jump out, it's not easy to jump back in to corporate after you jump out, you know. So mentally, I had to be prepared for that and to, you know, commit to myself to always maintain my skill set to a high level so that I can have that versatility on an ongoing basis going forward.
So when you left Ernst & Young and you're now at Alabama A&M, correct? That's where you were. So what did you start? You started there, you know, and then I'm sure you made some transitions while you were there. So talk a little bit about that.
Right. So I ran the compliance and audit office, and it hadn't been staffed for a few years. So I had to rebuild it. And this is a role that reported directly into the president, you know, and, you know, a year into that. So that's doing audits and investigations and performance improvement consultations so we can streamline processes and so forth. A year into that, the CFO there got a senior VP or executive vice president position at another university, and there was short notice. So the president asked, hey, Clayton, can you tide over this position until we can do a full search and have a smooth handover? You know, I said, not a problem, happy to. And I do remember my first few days on the job in that role on an interim basis, asking myself, what have I gotten into here? Right? Because there's a lot of stuff that comes through a CFO office, even if you're doing it on an interim basis, you know, seeing it for the first time was a lot. And I remember saying to myself, you know, it's interim, you know, what do I have to lose here? You know, so I made up in my mind, hey, look, I'm going to, you know, I'm bringing certain skills to the office. So I'm going to run as hard as I can, change as many things as possible, because there were certain things that when you're not in that office, there are different processes that you see that can be improved. So I said, well, while I'm there, I want to change as many of those processes as possible. So when I go back to my compliance operation, I can have the benefit of, you know, faster processes across campus.
So did that work?
The fixing processes worked.
Yes, that's what I want. Yeah, the fixing processes, did that work?
Yeah, it worked really well.
Good.
No, getting out of the CFO office did not work. Because what happens is if you, and I was on a mission because I really felt like it was a time crunch. So I started revamping as many processes as possible that were, some were low hanging fruit. It wasn't sophisticated. Then others were more long standing problems that we started to chip away at, you know. But what happens is if you're working for a president, you're working for a board, and they're seeing that movement over a period of months, 6 months, within a year, the president decided, you know what, I'm going to appoint you permanently to this position because we just want to keep that progress moving. I ended up working for that president for a number of years, and he was a great mentor to me as well.
Yes, and we'll definitely talk more about the mentorship. But I do want to talk about some of the surprises and some of the things that you recognized when you went from corporate to higher ed. Talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah. So I love how much faculty and staff actually care about students and the mission. You know, for folks that don't work in higher ed, it really is heartwarming, the amount of meetings I sit in where constantly someone in the room will bring us back to, yes, but how will this impact students? Yes, will they be able to afford? How does it affect their mental health? Over and over, every day, I hear that. And it really feels as if folks are on the same page of wanting to help make students better. So I love that. It does work slower compared to corporate. Right. So it does require an adjustment in expectations on speed. Right. But work-life balance is also great. You don't always get that in corporate. It's a harder thing to find, you know. But higher education institutions, even though we do offer PhDs and bachelor's and other advanced degrees, we're not always the fastest when it comes to change, right? Whether good or bad, just change as a whole can sometimes be slower. And that too was a surprise to me because I thought in a learning environment, change would happen fast. And that's not always the case. So,
right. Yes. Well, I do want to go back and discuss mentorship because I know that is very important. And I want to talk about some of your mentors that have helped you along the way. Maybe starting at Ernst & Young and then making that transition to higher ed.
Yes, I had good mentors at Ernst & Young. For example, I remember one person telling me early on, you know, focus on it hard on your career and acquire technical skill sets, but you also want to be involved in the community, especially as you rise, right? And I remember that person telling me, in some form or fashion, everyone that you'll see in leadership, in some form or fashion, usually they have some tentacle in the community, whether planned or whether it's just their nature. And I already had some of that going, but I remember ramping that up even more. And I've maintained that right through, you know, making sure I stay engaged with nonprofits because, you know, I was a first generation college attendee. And I see how a lot of these organizations help people prepare for college or provide opportunities or feed the homeless or help endangered kids, different organizations I've served on. So that was something she did advise me on. And it was valuable. I remember on more than one occasion, mentors and advisors aren't always senior level executives. It could be an assistant in the office that is really observant and understands the culture. In every environment I've walked into, and Ernst & Young was no different, there were always folks that understood the environment that could give me a sense of, like, here's some things you want to keep your eyes on. And it may not be things that are intuitive, but to know what you don't know. And when you walk in a new environment, there are things you don't know, right? So the faster you can get up to speed on some of the pitfalls or even folks that maybe best to stay away from, right? So I got a lot of that advice at Ernst & Young, and then mentors saying stuff like, you know, don't pick your career decision based on the weather, right? Because folks will say, hey, this place is hot, this place is cold. They said, yes, to some extent, but be careful how you use that as a benchmark. And then others said, hey, it's okay if you get a international rotation at some point in your career. You know, you do it for a year, you do it for 2 years, come on back, you know, and you can add a lot of value at the company. So they really give me a mindset of being open to opportunities wherever it may be.
Well, I do want to talk about your transition to the University of North Texas. How did that come about?
So I worked for my previous president for 10 years, right? For 9 of those years as his CFO. And again, he too was a great mentor, taught me a lot about higher education and how to think about things with critical thinking with the board. And one thing he was a stickler for example, is if you make a decision, it needs to be good regardless of who the person is, right? So be consistent in decision making and understand that there's no such thing as a secret. So if you make a decision, make sure it's one that can stand the test of public scrutiny. He announced his retirement about 3 years ago, but he gave us a 1-year heads up, and I had no reason to leave. I mean, I really loved the university. I loved the students, the employees. I mean, we felt like a family in the board. I had a great relationship there, but something called me just to look online a few months after he had given us that heads up, and I saw an opportunity for University of North Texas. Wasn't very familiar with it, but researched it, and I really felt drawn to what I saw, you know, to the student profile, to the things that the university was doing, the tier one research institution, HSI institution. There are a lot of things that the university was doing, and it kept harping on the mantra of caring, you know, so I really felt it aligned with my values, and I make a lot of decisions based on values, you know, and I applied and went through the interview process, and the more I saw, the more impressed I was. I remember interviewing on the campus and thinking to myself, I really hope I this works out, because now that I'm here and I'm seeing all these students and seeing the things the university is doing and trying to do, building a new campus in Frisco at the time and so forth, I said, I really want to be a part of this story and, you know, playing a part.
Yes, I did not realize that the University of North Texas was so diverse and is known for its diversity. And as I was researching, I was like, oh my goodness, I did not know that about the school. And it was really fascinating. So talk to us a little bit more about everything that you are over or that you're responsible for at the University of North Texas.
So UNT, we're 47,000 students and we're third largest in the state of Texas. And I oversee finance and administration. So that covers the facilities department, that covers law enforcement and security, it covers transportation and parking, risk management. So think insurance and environmental services, waste hauling. It covers the budget office, of course. We have a controller team as well for our campus. And then EO and Title IX, which are federal requirements that we have to maintain here on campus. And then we have something unique called Texas Municipal Clerks as well. We do the programming for the Municipal Clerks Association here across the state of Texas. You know, so we probably have about 480 employees or so across the division, and every day our goal really is to be the best support service we can be, so that our students can have a good experience, we can have good facilities and a safe environment, and that we keep costs low so that our students can, you know, graduate with minimal college debt possible.
Yeah. And speaking of that, let's talk about some of the workforce related challenges. So what are some of the solutions that you all have come up with? Now, you've been there, let's let everybody know, you've been there since 2021.
That's right.
Correct. Yeah. So yes, we want to let people know that you've been there for a few years now. So what are some of the workforce related solutions that you've addressed since you've been there when it comes to employees?
Like a lot of our universities, certainly here in the state of Texas, we have suffered from attrition. And I don't know if, you know, Nakubo has the Tsukuba regional arm, and also we have a Texas Tsukuba, you know, so as CFOs, we all meet, you know, 2-3 times a year, and we talk about our challenges, and we all have the same challenges. And attrition was one thing that afflicted all of us, because you get a company offering someone, you know, 15% more. And if you ever fall into that trap of chasing that, then you create inequity among your other employees who are also not at market, right? And we're tuition funded, right, in large part, which means we can't just increase our prices 5%, 8% like grocery store suppliers do, right? On our campus, we focus hard on making sure we provide folks work-life balance and emphasizing the benefits. So we'll have the week off during December, for example, you know, for that, you know, the holidays, you know, traditionally the Christmas holiday period. You know, you get a full week off. You know, Thanksgiving, you know, at least half that week, and most folks tend to take the remaining days, so they have the entire week off. You know, we have graduations, festivals, so we try to ensure folks are working. But if we can make this the least stressful environment, where you're going to event on the library mall where there are students and there are others, but we encourage our faculty and the staff to take advantage of it. Go to the graduation, go to the soccer game, go to the football game, basketball games, right? Take advantage of everything the university has to offer, right? So we've also spent a lot of time in the past year to 2 years at the chancellor's his vision to help ensure we reduce first year attrition in particular, because it's that first year that an employee is at highest risk, because we need to spend more time, and we have done it successfully here on campus. We're spending more time during interviews explaining who we are. Here are the values that we live by, and here's what your pay is, here's what you should expect, here's what your benefits will be. And a lot of conversation on what to expect, so that when you do arrive, there's no mismatch. And then for that first few days, weeks, months, for example, I provide all my employees a welcome packet. And that has a UNT branded gear. It has, you know, they have come have a one-on-one meeting with me for 15 minutes. So to get access to me and to get reoccurring access, we have breakfasts where I'll have 12 people, and we'll do that every month. So at any given moment throughout the year, folks have as many touch points as possible for conversation and connection, because we really feel that connection is what helps folks to stay. Pay is important, but we can't compete with Amazon, right, as far as pay. And a lot of those companies too, by the way, are also offering tuition benefits, or they'll pay for their employees. So some of the things we've traditionally had as advantages aren't always holding up the same way. So we've got to be more resourceful.
Yeah, I like that. I was going to ask about the touch points. Like, what is your feedback loop that you get with the staff once they are there? So you have breakfasts. I know people are listening. They may want to get some ideas. So I like that you do the breakfasts. Are there any other things that you do to kind of, you know, check in with them?
Yeah, I also do town hall meetings. I'll sometimes just walk campus just to give them opportunities to run into me, you know, because, you know, we have, I don't know, 6,000 employees, you know, so to run into the CFO, and I know your name, you know, like, I'm concerned when my employees have tragedies, and we had some last week, and I call them at home, you know, to how are you doing? You know, we have to care about our people, you know, and if we can give them proper work-life balance, help make the work environment stress-free as much as possible, right? And keep everyone focused on serving students, it gives us more long-term traction here in the organization. But at the breakfasts, I encourage folks to ask me difficult questions. If I know the answer, I'll tell you. And if I don't know, I'll tell you that too, right? But it really is giving them transparency, so they understand there's no black box here. There's no mystery. You know, we're all on the same team. And that question you have is a good question. And guess what? The whole breakfast idea, I got that idea from an employee in the budget office who said, hey, you know, it would be good to have breakfasts. I'm like, that's a great idea. You know, so we started that. So I'm saying employees have some of the best feedback and suggestions. We just got to harness that and create opportunities to validate them.
Right. And have opportunities for them to share what those ideas are. So that's awesome. So I'm noticing your leadership style is very relational. I like that. And I know that's kind of how your mentors have worked with you. So talk to me a little bit more about your leadership lessons and your leadership philosophy.
So again, I've had the fortune of good mentors. They don't always have to be folks that have a, you know, a high title. It's just folks that have really good critical thinking skills. They're observant. You know, for example, I'll give an example. The chancellor and my president, you know, because we're part of a system, we were in a meeting last year talking about a real estate transaction. You know, I remember the chancellor looking at me and asking me, yeah, but what's the cap rate? I mean, cap rate. Like, I mean, I knew what it meant, but I mean, to get that question from a higher education leader, the chancellor of the system, right, or the president, I mean, that caught me off guard. You know, we get that in corporate, and it's normal, it's typical, right? But it tells you the type of leadership we have here, you know, with the president, the chancellor, and others, where it's not just about buying something so we can put students in it and use it for teaching. What's the return on investment? Are we using these scarce tuition dollars and scarce public resources as optimally as possible, right? I've also learned, you know, soft skills are really important. It's sometimes it's not what you say, it's how you say. And I can't emphasize that enough to folks that aspire to leadership. There's a lot of good things and bad things that happen based on how you say things. You know, across my career, I've had to move a lot, right? From South Carolina to Indiana to Chicago to Alabama to Texas, right? I mean, moving from Alabama to Texas is maybe 700 miles, if I had to guess. And there's no family here. My wife, she's from South Carolina, so we don't know anyone here. You know, we had to start fresh, right? And something I've learned early on from, you know, both this president, the previous president I worked for, is you got to lean into fear. And that sometimes seems like an oxymoron, but you can't let fear guide your decision making. You know, some fear is healthy, but the true way to really minimize fear is to, you know, hone your craft, you know, be really good at what you do, be open-minded, and build meaningful relationships with folks, right? But that periodic knot of uncertainty in your stomach, that's a sign of you reaching your full potential. I'm not saying it's comfortable, but if you go to sleep comfortable every night and you don't ever have that knot, I would say to you pretty confidently, you're probably not reaching your true potential. So lean into fear and be genuinely interested in the well-being of people, you know, how they're doing. If you're a family, you're supposed to care if their son is sick or if their wife has cancer. You should care, you know, and I'm telling you, it really makes a difference for employees if they know we care.
No, we have to, we're human and we have to tap into that. And I love that. And I love that you're basically step out of your comfort zone. If you're not doing that, then you may not be reaching your full potential. That's a great nugget. I love it. So I want to talk about the vision for yourself as you move into the future and what this is a twofold loaded question. So I want to know what your future looks like in higher ed. And I also want to get your take on the future of higher ed.
Yeah, that's a broad world out there.
Oh, it is. Oh,
it's
I know.
A big world. So. Yeah. You know, time will tell what the future looks like for higher education, you know, but if you ask me, you know, change can sometimes happen at a rapid pace, right? So for example, during the COVID era coming out, we had a lot of high inflation. I think is more under control now, but it resulted in, you know, we had a lot of folks not working, you know, salaries went up at a faster rate than, and real estate taxes and insurance and all these expenses have gone up faster than tuition. So it creates a tight squeeze for universities that are really cost conscious like us. You know, we're very cost conscious because I want to say 30% of our students are eligible for Pell Grants, right? So they're low resource, right? So they're coming to school to UNT with a dream, a vision. They want to better themselves. And we really hold on to that. Students that are coming here and willing to work hard and just need a pathway, need a little help to get there, right? So it forces us to be more and more efficient, but it also could force us to start looking hard at things that we do that add value, but we may need to redeploy that money to something else that has higher value as a matter of survival. Otherwise, there could be a slow bleed. You know, I do think in the future too, and I'm not clairvoyant, but I do think the model we have could change in maybe 5-10 years, or it may never happen, but it could be more of a competency-based model. So as opposed to your traditional semester that lasts 3-4 months, you know, it might be videos that folks can take on demand. You know, where a professor pre-recorded these and you can take it at your own speed and you can do a test, and, you know, maybe it's a video test and it can authenticate who you are. And, you know, think of the single mom who has 2 kids that needs to study at night, then she can move faster. So I do see that happening. I see artificial intelligence playing a bigger role, both in corporate, but also higher education. It's going to affect our workforce and how fast we do our jobs or who does what parts of our jobs. You know, I would also say, you know, I work at a university, but sometimes I've seen where we can overqualify for jobs, where we work in higher education, but we have to focus hard on skill sets when we hire people. I try to encourage people to focus on, does this person have the right technical skills? Do they have the right judgment or ability to solve problems and inspire teams? You know, and focus a little bit less on sometimes was strictly on paper, right? We want to make sure we have people that have the right fit to take universities to this future that in some form or fashion is going to be very different from what we know of right now. We do know we'll always be a repository for learning, but how that happens, I feel, is going to look very different from what we've seen in the past that we may be relying on. And we also have to let folks know that it is valuable to have a college degree. Everyone doesn't need to have a college degree because there are different pathways for different people. But there is value to a college degree, and we've got to keep our cost affordable so that it's a worthwhile endeavor for folks. So as far as my future, you know, I really enjoy what I do as a CFO. I love what I do. I love being close enough to the action where I can still engage with folks and solve problems and still not be in a world where it's just 100% politics. I actually get to be in the operations and solve problems and make the lives of students better. Again, I was a first generation college attendee. My mom worked at an orphanage. So each time I see students cross that stage, I'm winning. You know, I'm winning. Once they cross that stage, they can go out there and thrive.
That's awesome. Wow. Well, they are definitely fortunate to have you there at the University of North Texas. I just thank you for all that you're doing and continue to do. It's been a wonderful conversation, and I just appreciate talking to you today.
I've had fun, Donna. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And thank you all for joining us today for this episode of CBO Speaks. It's brought to you by the National Association of College and University Business Officers. You can find resources for today's episode, as well as a wide variety of research and tools at nakubo.org. Make sure you subscribe to the CBO Speaks podcast wherever you get your podcasts so that you can get the latest episodes instantly. And on behalf of Clayton Gibson from the University of North Texas, I want to thank you for joining us on CBO Speaks. I'm Donna Shealy. Be well. CBO Speaks is a production of the National Association of College and University Business Officers. Audio engineered by Andy Nelson and True Story FM. Music by Michael Bean. Post-production support by Janelle Dempsey. And I'm your host, Donna Shealy. Thank you for listening.